Welcome to the Saturday Frights Podcast. I am the Projectionist, your co-host for this radio program. Now, come join your host, Vic Sage, as we enter the vault to once again discuss retro horror films and television programs. There! That should do it! Let us fire up the old girl and see if the issue has been corrected.
Good evening, folks, and a hearty welcome to our drive-in theater. We have a wonderful evening's entertainment lined up for you, one that will provide several hours of pleasurable relaxation and diversion for you and your family.
Perfect! That will do nicely.
Hey there, projectionist. Were you able to get the projector all tuned up?
Tuned up? This beautiful machine is no hot rod needing a tune-up. It is the epitome of mechanical perfection.
Which is why when we were showing Trilogy of Terror last night, the film was trying to come off the platter, right?
Nonsense. The Haunted Drive-In takes care of the small matters. Remind me, who was working the projection booth the other evening?
You know who it was. It was Rockford J. Which, by the way, having him work all day in the vault and then cover the evening's showing isn't exactly fair. You should have called me to—
You have already hit the nail on the head, Victor. It must have been something that intern Rockford J. did on his shift the other evening. Yes. Besides, you needed tuning up yourself. How long have you been sick?
Almost a month, but I'm feeling much better now. Thank you. You really should have called me in.
Remind me, when the last Saturday Frights radio show was aired?
Our last Saturday Frights podcast episode was at the end of October.
Correct, Sage. And is this not the month of December?
You know it is, projectionist. With my work schedule as hectic as it is, plus getting sick, I just couldn't manage to record a new podcast with you. I'm sure our listeners understand. Besides, I still say I became sick because of one of those plague rats. I was walking down the hallway on level 5 of the vault, and she, well, I assume it's a she, the plague rat was carrying a pink parasol and wearing a dress.
Bobby Joe and the rest of his plague ratkin do like to play dress up, dear boy.
Well, one of its quills nicked me as we passed each other, and the next day, I'm bedridden for almost 2 weeks.
I've not heard of any of our fellow vault co-workers becoming ill from contact with the plague rats.
That's probably because we put a stop at them working in the food court. Anyway, I'm looking forward to recording a new show, projectionist.
Speaking of, it appears as if your recording bracelet is active. Much easier to move about now, eh? No need to be tied down to a control room and such.
You're right. And hey there, friends. Thanks for taking the time out of your busy schedule and listening to the Saturday Frights podcast. I was just explaining to the projectionist on why there was sadly no new episode for the month of November. But on today's show, we're going to be tackling a good one. I'm talking about the 1976 atmospheric haunted house picture, Burnt Offerings. In fact, this was a film I suggested to our friends, Sean and Nicole Johnson of the excellent Horrified Chicken podcast, when they were gracious enough to ask me to pick a film I thought they might like. I will be sure to include a link to their show covering Burnt Offerings on the Pop Culture Retrorama article for today's podcast. It should make for an enjoyable juxtaposition. Projectionist, first of all, I assume you showed this 1976 film here at the Haunted Drive-In when it was originally released.
Most assuredly. Although it did not fare so well, I must admit. The slow build-up of the picture appeared to divide the audience. Having said that, however, those that stuck around to the end of the feature were quite impressed by its payoff. What about yourself, Victor? Is this a picture you caught at that 62 drive-in of your youth?
No, although Burnt Offerings would have been awesome to see there. I first caught this movie thanks to the TBS Superstation. Friends, I've shared before how my father, as a steelworker, would get me up about 5 in the morning when he was leaving for work. This allowed for quite a bit of time to watch TV, as the bus wouldn't come around to pick me up for nearly 2 hours after he left. So, I flipped on the TV, and I catch, like, the last half of the movie, as it was being shown on the Late Late Show. I was totally riveted. It's not like we had handy guides back then to tell us what was playing, so I had to wait until the end of the film to find out what the movie's name was. This would have been back in the early 80s, so when I told my father about it when he got home, we took a quick trip uptown to try and rent it. We were in luck, and that was that night's viewing entertainment. And things made a lot more sense after getting a chance to catch the first half of the film.
Why would one even attempt to begin to watch a film that had already started, Victor?
I didn't have much of a choice in the matter, my friend. Besides, it just took a few minutes of watching what was going on with Oliver Reed, Karen Black, and Lee Montgomery to get sucked into Burnt Offerings, like I mentioned a moment ago. Actually, you mentioned that when you originally played the movie, it didn't do so well. That kind of seems to echo the majority of reviews that I have read online about it. After attending the premiere of the film on August 25th of 1976, Variety released an article that, while praising the work of young Lee Montgomery, stated, quote, "The horror is expressed through sudden murderous impulses felt by Black and Reed, a premise which might have been interesting if director Dan Curtis hadn't relied strictly on formula treatment," end quote. The New York Times, however, had a different opinion. Not only using Burnt Offerings is an outstanding terror movie as the headline, and while questioning director Dan Curtis's choices in the climax of the film, stated, quote, "Nevertheless, such is his ability that, at the approach of the denouement during a preview of Burnt Offerings, members of the audience began murmuring and shouting nervous jokes in a vain effort to break the undeniable tension. Rental agents hereabouts should get down on their knees and give thanks that Burnt Offerings is opening now. It's the kind of movie that does for summer homes what Jaws did for A Dip in the Surf," end quote. So, I guess you can see that Burnt Offerings has a tendency to split its audience. While I will certainly agree with all of the reviews that I've read that the film is not perfect, because most are not, you either dig the creepy and slow-building moodiness of the picture, or you just think it's a slog to get through. Now, the one thing that I believe that even in the harshest of reviews is correct about is that while there is a great deal of talent on display both in front of and behind the camera, it does very much feel like a made-for-TV movie. I don't mean that as a slight, of course. It's just with the late and great Dan Curtis, who directed the film, getting his start in television, he was probably playing to what he knew best. Where, say, another director that was used to feature films might have taken a different approach with the way the film was shot.
Yes, Dan Curtis, of the Night Stalker fame,
The one and the same. He was producer of that original 1972 TV movie that would later bring us the exceptional Kolchak The Night Stalker series. In fact, Curtis would direct the 1973 sequel to The Night Stalker, The Night Strangler. But 5 years before all of that, Curtis was largely responsible for another television series of some renown. Dan Curtis acted as director for 20 episodes and was executive producer and creator on the 1,225-episode run of this groundbreaking daytime soap opera.
Yes?
I'd like to see Mrs. Stoddard, if you'd be so kind.
Mrs. Stoddard?
This is Collinwood, isn't it?
Yes.
And the mistress here is Mrs. Elizabeth Collin Stoddard, is she not?
Yes.
Then perhaps you'd do me the courtesy to inform Mrs. Stoddard that her cousin is calling and wishes to pay his respects.
Her cousin?
Yes, her cousin from England. Oh, madam, if you would, you may tell her that it's Barnabas Collins.
Yes, indeed. Dan Curtis was responsible for the gothic soap opera Dark Shadows.
Oh, I can remember watching that episodic television show here at the Haunted Drive-In. Young Toby brought in a small black and white model television. We would watch it together during the setting up of the concession stand for the evening's performances.
Dan Curtis would go on to direct the two Dark Shadows feature films, House of Dark Shadows in 1970, with Night of Dark Shadows the following year, as well as the Norlis tapes in 73 and a production of Dracula in 74, the latter starring the likes of Jack Palance as Dracula, with the Monster Club's Simon Ward as Arthur Holmwood, and The Island of Dr. Moreau's Nigel Davenport as Dr. Abraham Van Helsing. Palance and Curtis had worked together before, back in 1968, when Curtis produced The Strange Case of Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde. By the time that Curtis signed up to direct Burnt Offerings, he had already delivered the incredibly memorable TV horror anthology, The Trilogy of Terror, which just so happened to feature one of his leads from Burnt Offerings, the late and great Karen Black. The screenplay for Burnt Offerings was co-written by both Dan Curtis and William F. Nolan, who worked with Curtis before, crafting the teleplays for the Norlis tapes, The Turn of the Screw, and the Trilogy of Terror. The last being an adaptation of three of Richard Matheson's stories, I should add. In fact, Burnt Offerings is an adaptation of the 1973 novel of the same name, by Robert Marasco. While I've not had the pleasure of reading the source material as of yet, I've heard that the ending was altered because Curtis felt the book's finale was too open-ended. I've also read that Curtis had actually read Burnt Offerings when it was originally released, and had quite enjoyed it, beyond the ending. And it appears as if the producers offered the director's chair first to Bob Fosse. Yes, that Bob Fosse. And it almost happened, but the project fell apart at the last minute. This was supposedly in 1970. You see, Burnt Offerings had been written by Robert Marasco as a screenplay before he decided to rework it a couple of years later as a book. The producers also offered the project to George Roy Hill, who you might know best as the director for 1973's The Sting, as well as On Golden Ponds' Mark Rydell, both obviously passed on the film. So it was that Dan Curtis got the job, and in August of 1975, he shot Burnt Offerings at the Dunsmuir House in Oakland, California, in just a mere 30 days. And, as I understand it, even the interiors of the house were used for the film, as Curtis had claimed there wasn't a single set built for the film.
The exterior of the house in Burnt Offerings looked quite familiar, Sage.
As well it should, projectionist. It was used in Don Coscarelli's excellent Phantasm in 1979, as the outside of the Morningside Cemetery funeral home. It would also be featured in 1985's A View to a Kill, 1993's So I Married an Axe Murderer, and two feature films in 1999, the remake of 1980's Gloria, and Clint Eastwood's True Crime.
The Dunsmuir House. Yes, I recall it had something of a tragic nature behind its origins. Did it not?
That is true. It was constructed in 1899 by Alexander Dunsmuir, who happened to be the son of Robert Dunsmuir, a prosperous coal magnate that hailed from Victoria in British Columbia. Alexander had intended the home to be a wedding gift for his bride, but while they were on their honeymoon in New York, he became sick and died. His wife did move into the house, but died herself in 1901. Although it appears as if the sadness ends there, I'm happy to say. The new owners, beginning in 1906, appeared to have kept it into the 1950s, before the city of Oakland would purchase it. I suppose this is a good point to jump into the synopsis for Burnt Offerings. If you've not had the pleasure of seeing it for yourself, you might want to pause the podcast, as we will be going fully into spoiler territory. Before we do that, though, Projectionist, I believe you located a vintage TV commercial for Burnt Offerings?
Indeed I have, dear boy.
It all began as a summer vacation. A young family found a beautiful old house. They thought it was the answer to their dreams.
$900, and then it's all ours.
But it was the beginning of a nightmare. Burnt Offerings, starring Karen Black.
Are you actually trying to tell me that this house is responsible?
Oliver Reed.
This house is destroying us.
Betty Davis.
This house is getting so cold.
Burgess Meredith.
So you are the people who want to rent this house.
Eileen Heckert.
God, when it comes alive, tell him, brother.
Help me! Burnt Offerings. Rated PG.
As Burnt Offerings begins, we are introduced to the Rolfe family. Ben, played by Oliver Reed, Marion, played by Karen Black, and their 12-year-old son, David, played by Lee Montgomery. The trio are traveling from the city to check out a possible summer home, an advertisement that Marion spotted in the newspaper, apparently. While the original setting in the source material was located in New York, for the purposes of the film adaptation, it was changed to California. I think it's pretty safe to say that Ben is not quite as excited as Marion is, not just about the trip, but the possibility of them affording to rent what we will soon learn is the Allardyce House, a 19th century mansion that, while it might have seen better days, still shows more than a little of the nobility that would have made it the talk of the town back in the day. Although it certainly will need a bit of work to get it back up to shape. Vines cover much of the facade, and everything from the grass around the Allardyce residence, including the numerous remains of the flowers within the greenhouse, are dead and withering away.
Dear listeners, the Allardyce House is named so as it is owned by two elderly siblings, Arnold and Rosalind Allardyce.
Correct, Projectionist, played wonderfully by Burgess Meredith and Eileen Eckhart. Arnold is confined to a wheelchair, and while both are played as quite quirky, there is some very, very real menace to how they behave. In fact, I think that Ben is the only one to pick up on that something is not right about the Allardyce twins.
Marion, on the other hand, seems absolutely captivated by the place. Entranced by its beauty, would you not say? She is immediately drawn to the numerous photographs that line the tables and walls of the home, from the many decades since its construction.
Oh, totally. In fact, Marion, on the drive up, almost acts like the house is calling to her, so to speak.
Which, from what you told me, Sean Johnson mentioned on their own radio broadcast, this might be the truth, eh?
You're getting a little ahead. We'll talk about that at the end of the synopsis. Right off the bat, though, like I was saying, we can tell things are off about the Allardyce siblings. Things start off bizarrely when Ben and Marion meet Roz. For one thing, we learn that the amount the two Allardyces are asking in rent from the beginning of July 1st until Labor Day is only $900. $900 for the rental of a mansion for 2 months. for all three of the Ralphs. Plus, Ben's 60-year-old Aunt Elizabeth, played by the legendary Bette Davis. Sure, it'll be a bit of a working vacation, but it's a steal to say the least. But the Ralphs appear to have to pass a test first, in the form of Arnold. Although the rather flamboyant man is quite excited to find out they have a 12-year-old boy with them. In fact, he quickly changes the subject when he spots David hurt his leg while climbing outside, doing his best to make sure that Ben stays away from the window after the accident.
Do you rent often?
It depends.
Well, what my sister is trying to say is that we have this desperate need of rest and relaxation. I'm coming apart, as you can see.
Oh, brother.
Oh, brother is right. Well, do you like it?
We love it.
Really?
God, when it comes alive, tell them, brother. Tell them what it's like in the summer.
Well, they'd never believe it. It's beyond anything that you have ever seen in your life.
There's centuries in this room, Mrs. Roth. There are years, years in this house.
Oh, yes. And this house will be here long, long after you have departed, you believe me?
It's practically immortal. I sincerely believe that.
So do I.
To the point of being rude, Ben admits that the deal is too good to be true, and wants to know what the catch is. There is sort of a catch with the low price of the rental. While the Allardyce twins need to go on vacation, they are not planning on bringing the recluse of a mother.
An 85-year-old woman that Rosalind Allardyce imagines could pass for 60. But she never leaves her room in the upstairs section of the mansion. The Ralphs are naturally expected to bring her breakfast, lunch, and dinner, leaving the tray outside her bedroom, in the sitting room.
There is one other thing, projectionist. Arnold's sister mentions that it sounds odd, but they will only agree to rent it to the Ralphs. And more importantly, this is directed to Marion, that they agree to love the house as much as they do, treat it like their own. Marion is absolutely ready to close the deal right there and then. Like the projectionist said, she is totally captivated by the place, but Ben wisely asks if it's okay they think about it. The Ralphs begin to head back home, but not before David comes in. It appears that he scratched up his leg pretty bad when he fell outside. I bring this up because, shock, this is the first instance we are shown that the house might indeed be immortal, and it requires all manner of sustenance to keep itself in shape. You see, after the Ralphs leave, the Allardyces have this coot of a handyman played by the iconic Dub Taylor. He's about to throw out a dead plant. He's stopped, very coldly, by Arnold, who demands that he take another look at the plant. And we can now see that the plant has a fresh new sprout taking root.
The Allardyce house would appear to be something of a vampire, wouldn't you say, Victor?
I think that is the perfect way to describe it. Although, it also acts very much like the Overlook Hotel from Stephen King's The Shining. Actually, I have read that Stephen King has admitted that the source material influenced him a little bit with his own novel. The Shining, of course, was published in 1977. Supposedly, he enjoys the film adaptation of Burnt Offerings as well. It is plain to see that Marion has her heart set on renting the Allardyce place. And after sort of guilting Ben into it, the family's summer plans are in place. When we next see the Ralph family with Aunt Elizabeth in tow, they are excitedly driving up to the mansion. But the oddness involving the Allardyce twins continues, as upon arriving, they find that there's been an envelope left with a note in the keys to the place taped on the front door. The note explaining that the twins had to leave earlier than expected.
I understood it to be that the twins left earlier that morning, Sage.
I agree with you. My first thought was for their 85-year-old mother, which appears to be Marion's first thoughts as well, as she immediately heads upstairs to pay the old woman a visit. She notices a tray outside the bedroom door, the food upon it having been eaten. Knocking on the door to the bedroom and introducing herself, there is no response. But Marion, curiously enough, explains on leaving the upstairs area to her family that there is going to be a rule. She will be the only one allowed to go upstairs. And while we see she didn't meet the elderly Mrs. Allardyce, she says that the older woman is sleeping. The Allardyce siblings might be odd, but they were kind enough to stock up the larder and refrigerator and freezer with all manner of food, steaks, liquor, snacks.
All worthy of last meals for the condemned.
You've hit on something there, projectionist. Anyway, we get another glimpse at how the Allardyce house works in a scene where Ben cuts his hand opening a bottle of champagne. Where, moments before, when Aunt Elizabeth tried the light switch to the pantry and found it dead, when David enters moments later and flips the switch, it is all brightly lit. Marion really throws herself into cleaning up the house. I would go so far as to say she is slightly manic about restoring the inside to its former glory. Busying herself day and night while Ben and David clean out the sludge from the pool in the back of the house. It must have been ages since it was given a proper cleaning. I should point out that Betty Davis is incredibly charming in the film as Aunt Elizabeth. Playful and sarcastic, she is definitely a woman who might be in her 60s, but doesn't act it. She's quite lively and a child at heart, acting almost like a grandmother to David. After shoveling out the leaves and other crud that is built up in the pool, and with the help of a pump, the Ralphs are soon able to enjoy it. But the Allardyce house has other plans. For one thing, after Ben is dove into the pool, he manages to find at the bottom of it a pair of glasses. It's not his, and one of the lenses is cracked, as if something sharp had pierced it. Aunt Elizabeth is busying herself lounging by the pool, having fun watching Ben and David, who quickly joins his father. Ben begins to act incredibly odd, first like he's mesmerized by the glasses, and then something horrible happens. Ben puts on the glasses and begins to act quite aggressive to his son, flipping him off his shoulders into the pool. A game at the beginning, before it is quite apparent, he is literally trying to drown David. Aunt Elizabeth is of course screaming for Ben to let David go, and the young boy is fighting and kicking. At one point, Ben is holding David down with his legs up out of the water. Thankfully for the young boy, he's able to get a hold of his diving mask he was first wearing when he jumped in, and slams it into Ben's face, who lets him go. David, emotionally devastated, rushes off to the safety of Elizabeth, and we see Ben with this murderous anger in his eyes as blood is pouring from his nose, half submerged in the water, just swim off to the deeper end of the pool.
Do you believe, Sage, this was a case of possession? That the spirit of whomever owned those glasses took possession of Ben Ralph when he put them on?
That is a possibility, of course. It is left up to the viewer to form their own opinion, I suppose. Like I've mentioned, the Allardyce place acts a bit like the Overlook Hotel, playing on your fears and such. You made mention of the house being a vampire, and I think even this bit of violence, the house is totally feeding on it. I've already said that Burnt Offerings has a slow build-up. The tension from the film, since it's a haunted house movie, isn't in jump scares, but the continuous dread of what is happening to the Ralph family. They are all likable people. Major credit going to the cast and their fine performances. You do care about Elizabeth, Ben, and especially David. You worry about Marion too. But, to be fair, her personality changes extremely quickly in the film. She seems to be really taking that promise to care for the house as if it were her own to heart. Not just with the continuous cleaning, but telling her husband and family bold-faced lies. Like, when all the clocks in the house, and there are a good number of them, wind themselves up and begin to function properly beginning at midnight, a couple of nights after they've moved in. Marion says she wound them all, when we plainly see she had nothing to do with it. Ben is the one who first begins to believe that something is really, really wrong with the Allardyce house. Not just because of his completely bizarre behavior in the pool. Later that evening, he's awoken from a nightmare. One that involves an experience from his youth. When, at his mother's funeral, he was scared by a creepy chauffeur. Played by High Plains Drifter's Anthony James. A smiling and unnerving figure in black.
I have heard tell that Dan Curtis included this in the picture, as it was based on a real-life incident, dear listeners.
You're right, my friend. Dan Curtis, who passed away in 2006, shared that when he was a young boy, his own mother had sadly passed away. And while at the funeral parlor, he saw the chauffeur outside by his vehicle laughing. Now, I doubt the man was laughing at anything to do with the Curtis's loss, but I can absolutely see how it would have affected him. Yet again, much like the Overlook Hotel from The Shining, Ben begins to see this chauffeur pop up. It can easily be explained away as the man might be cracking up. And while I'm getting ahead of myself, later in the film, though, both Aunt Elizabeth and Ben see the chauffeur. So, I personally believe the creepy guy is being projected by the Allardyce house, feeding off the paralyzing fear of Ben and his family. Marion, through the weeks and months that take place during burnt offering, spends more and more time taking care of the elderly Mrs. Allardyce. Like the Ralph family, we never see her ourselves, but Marion begins to wear the Victorian clothing of Mrs. Allardyce, spending so much time in the sitting room looking at the numerous photos that dot the room. Men and women who we can assume once were residents of the house. So many, though, and all from different eras. Actually, Dan Curtis can be spotted in Victorian attire in one of the photographs, by the way. The serving trays that Marion brings up aren't being touched. And at one point, we see she starts to eat the food herself while in the sitting room. I should also point out that of interest to Marion is Mrs. Allardyce's musical box that is in the sitting room. This would be a good spot to praise the work of Robert Cabaret, a composer who had worked with Dan Curtis previously on both the Dark Shadows TV show and two films, as well as The Night Stalker and The Night Strangler, to name a few. Actually, the soundtrack for Burnt Offerings was produced in a limited run of only 3,000 copies back in 2011. Only 35 years after the film was originally released to theaters. Speaking of that music box that Marion is so infatuated with, Cabaret winds that motif through the score to incredibly creepy effect. While these incidents that we've talked about are strange, it is plain to see that the family member that the Allardyce house truly goes after first is Aunt Elizabeth. She begins to sleep in almost the entire day. She barely has enough energy to make it downstairs to the dinner table. And we can see that she is being drained by the house. I mentioned she was lively. She begins to act like someone in her 80s before long, forgetting things. Something that Marion is quick to point out when one night the door to David's room mysteriously becomes locked, and the gas from a malfunctioning wall heater almost costs him his life. It's hard to watch this family get torn apart as the film progresses. And while I've already praised the cast, there is a point where the Allardyce house is tired of playing around. And Bette Davis's performance as she is attacked, it is so painful to watch. You can almost feel the life being drained out of her in her bedroom. And then there is the cracking of bone in what I've always assumed is her back being broken. While Ben and Elizabeth, who is crying out in pain, wait for an ambulance to arrive, this is the moment when they both see that chauffeur, who, grinningly, rolls a casket towards them both, a fright that kills Elizabeth. While afterwards, we see the obvious anguish that Ben and David are going through at the funeral, Marion apparently couldn't be bothered to attend. Instead, she is delighted to find that the greenhouse is now full of blooming flowers. It's an explosion of plant life in there. That night, well, Ben sees for himself what the house is capable of, almost like it's shedding its skin during a strong thunderstorm. The house is reborn. Old planks of wood and shingles fall like the rain that is downpouring outside. To the man's horror, he spies there is brand new painted wood and roofing underneath. Ben doesn't need any more goading. He takes David and attempts to flee in the family station wagon. But the Allardyce house has no intention of letting them go, causing a large tree to fall in front of the car. Ben, in desperation, attempts to ram the tree over and over again, or possibly push it out of the way. But to no avail. Ben kind of slips into a catatonic state, almost as if he realizes they are not going to be able to escape this fate.
yet, the very next day, while he stares numbly at his son in the pool. After, the Allardyce house attempts to drown his son by causing the water to act with the fury of the ocean itself. It is Marion who dives in and rescues her boy.
True projectionist, seeing this all, snaps Ben out of his stupor, and to his surprise, Marion, after David begs to leave the Allardyce home, agrees they are leaving that very day. The Ralphs waste no time. I don't believe they're even taking their luggage. Before they leave, however, Marion feels guilty about not telling Mrs. Allardyce they're taking off. Both David and her husband all but beg her not to go back into the house. But Marion rightfully explains they need to leave the elderly woman their phone number in case there is an emergency. After Marion heads up to talk to Mrs. Allardyce to explain the situation, she doesn't return. A little time passes, and Ben finally goes into the upstairs of the house to bring his wife back down so they can leave.
It would seem that Marion should have listened to her family,
Well, there's no sign of Marion, but Ben, upon entering the elderly Mrs. Allardyce's bedroom, sees the old woman in a rocking chair, which is facing the window, her white hair poking out over the top of the chair. At first, she doesn't appear to react to Ben's questions. Although, as the scene progresses, we the viewers can see he is angering her. We know this because we can see her hands clawing at the arms of her rocking chair. Ben finally confronts her, angrily twisting her chair around, and is shocked, as much as we the viewers are, to see that the aged and elderly Mrs. Allardyce is in fact Marion. Her skin has gone pale and white, and like I mentioned, her hair is pure white now too. Her dark eyes are now an icy blue-gray, and there is a most murderous look on her face. Ben is terrified beyond belief, as Marion mentions she has been waiting for him, and races up at him. Seconds later, we see the outside of the house. Ben is thrown through the bedroom window, where he plummets and is killed in a spray of gore as he lands headfirst through the windshield of the station wagon, right in front of a horrified David. You can't help but feel bad for the young boy as he bolts out of the car, screaming for his mother. The Allardyce house isn't finished, though, as the house begins to shake again, and a deep, ragged crack appears in the chimney on its roof. We the viewers and David watch in horror as it starts to fall, and his last cries of fear echo as the screen freezes on his shrieking as we hear the bricks and mortar collapse on him, killing the young boy.
That is not the very end of the film, however, dear listeners.
Quite true. After fading to black, we see the Allardyce house has renewed itself completely. The grass is green and flowers are everywhere. Everything looks like it has received a fresh coat of paint. The marble fountain beside the drive is working again. We see this taken as a photograph, as we hear the handyman, Arnold, and Rosalind talking in almost a whisper about how beautiful the place looks once again. In addition, they mention that their darling mother has returned to them, restored to them in all her glory and beauty once again. As Robert Cobert's music box score plays, we see that three new photos have been added to Mrs. Allardyce's sitting room. Three individual photos of David, Ben, and Aunt Elizabeth, all of them looking numb in these colored photographs. This ending obviously leaves a few questions that we can try to figure out. Let's start with those photographs. Like some of the others we have seen on the tables and walls of the house, the subjects sometimes look surprised they are having their photo taken. Are these just photos? Or, kind of like with The Shining, are these poor souls possibly trapped? Are they now part of the Allardyce house?
A good question, Victor. What of Marion Ralph, however? That would be the bigger mystery, would you not say?
Oh, totally. And that is something my father and myself chatted about after watching it on VHS. Granted, I already knew how it played out. So, does the Allardyce house possibly use its mother as a power battery, so to speak? You'll remember, when the Ralphs first arrived for the summer, the food upon the tray had been eaten. This could have been Rosalind and Arnold, of course. Or was there someone being used by the house when they first got there to keep it going? Now, not to spoil too much about Sean and Nicole's coverage of Burnt Offerings on their Horrified Chicken podcast, but Sean brought up something I had not thought of before. And once I heard him bring it up, I couldn't help but think he has possibly hit the nail on the head. In a nutshell, he thinks that maybe Marion has always been a part of the Allardyce family, that she is the mother of Arnold and Rosalind, that possibly every so many decades she's made young. Perhaps her children sacrifice some of their youth to do this, so that she can go out into the world and bring back a new family for the house to feed upon. I guess another option is that the house just ends up possessing a member of the family, transforming them completely. But yet again, I personally think Sean is right. His option is far more creepier in my opinion. And friends, I think that wraps up the synopsis for 1976's Burnt Offerings. For what it might be worth, we left quite a bit out. We hit the high notes, but there's plenty for you to discover on your own if you haven't seen the film for yourself. You can look around online and find it available for viewing. I should add, there is an excellent Blu-ray release that came out in 2015 that contains not only the original DVD audio commentary featuring Karen Black, Dan Curtis, and William F. Nolan, but adds a commentary by film historian Richard Harlan Smith, plus interviews with Lee Montgomery, William F. Nolan, and the creepy chauffeur himself, Anthony James. Now that I'm feeling better, assuming a plague rat doesn't get me sick again, the projectionist and myself should have a new matinee episode out soon. We will continue our discussion of Shudder's excellent Creepshow anthology. The next episode we discuss just so happens to feature Reanimator's Jeffrey Combs. And I believe that brings us to the end of our podcast. Friends, thank you again for taking the time out of your busy schedule to listen to the show. The music you heard at the beginning and ending of our podcast was provided by Peachy. My co-host, The Projectionist, has his own Facebook page, Projectionist Haunted Drive-In. He manages to share interesting trivia on films on a daily basis, or sometimes he'll just share vintage movie posters and behind-the-scenes photographs of some of your favorite films. As for myself, you can still find me posting a couple times a day on not just the Saturday Frights page, but the Diary of an Arcade Employee page too. I even managed to find time to share some things on the Retroist Clubhouse on Facebook now and again. Saturday Frights has an Instagram account, by the way. If you want to check it out, you can find it. It's simply Saturday_Frights. If you'd like to contact me with suggestion for future episodes, you can reach me at vicsagepopculture@gmail.com. For all things pop culture and retro related, we would love it if you could visit the Pop Culture Retrorama site. Generally, we have something of interest to share a couple times a day. Of course, we owe a great deal of gratitude to the Retroist himself. Not just for originally hosting the podcast, but for allowing us for nearly 10 years to share our love of all things retro. The Retroist is back, by the way. He may not be publishing on a daily schedule, but he is producing new podcasts and all manner of retro-related content. If you like the show, consider subscribing and giving us a rating over on iTunes. Our past catalog of episodes is slowly, very slowly, coming back online. But you can still listen to the entire collection over on the Internet Archive. So until next time, friends, the vault is sealed. This has been a Pop Culture Retrorama podcast. Goodbye, and thanks for listening. The Saturday Frights podcast is not affiliated with or authorized by any of the businesses or individuals that have been mentioned in the show. All music and sound clips from Burnt Offerings are the property of the respective copyright holders and no infringement is intended. Audio clips are included for the purpose of review, criticism, and commentary only and are not intended to infringe.